Hi, I'm Stan Brakhage. This is the second in a series of programs which will be aired weekly. And finally, we've got a title for this series. Listening to the first tape that we made a week ago, Len Baron suggested the title, The Test of Time. And I thought that sounds fine. And those of you that remember the story, I was talking about Kirkpatrick listening to Charles Ives, or rather to Charlie Ruggles, playing chords over and over again, and finally in irritation interrupting him and saying, how long is this going to go on? And without breaking stride, Charlie Ruggles said, I'm giving it the test of time. So that's how things come to be named, and that's a good name. I'll try to live up to it. Today I want to talk about Eugene O'Neill. I'm teaching a course at the University of Colorado in the drama of O'Neill and Williams, and I've been spending the whole summer steeped in O'Neill, reading Schaeffler's biography, which is about 800 pages, more than usually you'd want to know about any human being. And I want to, in the broadcast today, to just be very brief about something that I think is the major misunderstanding of Eugene O'Neill. Always, all my life, I've heard theater goers, actors, college professors, people in literature, damning O'Neill with faint praise in the form of saying that, well, he's a tremendously powerful writer for the theater. He may be America's greatest dramatist. But he couldn't write. Some of them are more specific about that. They say he couldn't write poetry, and that was his defeat, and so he stumbled on as best he could with his integrity. And I had bought this line about him. There's some truth to it, but there's a greater truth I've come to sense as I read his plays over and over again and think about his life and about all the creative people I've known. O'Neill could write poetry, and I'm going to prove it to you. Here's a poem that young Eugene O'Neill wrote. I know how the beast of the desert feels as the steel bars shut him in. I know how he fights a superior force with never a chance to win, how he paces across his narrow cage as he drags his life in fruitless rage. For I, too, am shut in. Bound by a chain of circumstance to a life that knows no peace, fettered more closely than bird or beast by duties that never cease, closely the bars of my cage are set, strong to withstand my wild regret and no hope of release. Now, that's a fine poem for those or any times. It's a poem in the sense of what was popular as poetry in America, and in fact, in the world at that time, certainly the English-speaking world. It's Kipling to some extent. It's more introspective and disturbing than Kipling. It's absolutely true of his life. It comes out of Thompson's The Hound of Heaven by way of Oscar Wilde's Ballad of Reading Jail, and It's a kind of poetry that was printed in the newspapers at that time, even. I don't mean in some obscure poetry section, but I mean even sometimes on the front pages, when appropriate. He could have been very successful as a poet. He chose not to be, or was forced not to be, by a circumstance that he did so much mean this statement that he made, his wild regret, that he couldn't express it with those old tum-ti-tum rhythmic lines and rhymes. They're really absurd when you have something that desperate to express. And with typical Yankee ingenuity, he took the risk and succeeded at throwing all that over as he began writing his plays. And in 1921, he came out with The Emperor Jones, in which he had by that time completely thrown away such poetics. I mean, I can't stand words that have tick attached to the end of them anyway. He had thrown them out, and as you'll hear in this example that I brought of James Earl Jones doing two scenes from O'Neill's Emperor Jones, he's content to have boxed in through the Provincetown Players on McDougal Street in 1921 to have boxed in an audience in a savage, wild scene of beating drums and finally screaming and whimpering and grunting, along with some of the hardest new sense of poetry that one could imagine. The inarticulate seeming, but carefully crafted and deeply felt and meant, statements of a man being reduced to terror in the jungle as he's hunted down by those whom once he ruled over. And also, which is more to the point, as his mind deteriorates under the influences of their voodoo or his own. So Eugene O'Neill, actually more than August Strindberg before him or anyone else, turns the stage into a human mind, or in fact the whole auditorium. And here's a good example of a couple scenes.
Only the silver one. If more of them hates come after me, how am I going to scare them away? Oh, Lord. Only the silver bullet left. And I got to say that for luck. If I choose that one, I'm a goner, sure. Oh, Lord. It's black here. Where's the moon? Oh, Lord. Don't this night ever come to an end? Like a clear place. I've got to lie down and rest. I don't care if them niggas does catch me. I got to rest.
There's no way to really give you the feeling over the air of this whole play, because it does depend upon a mix of the drums, the sight of the man, the background, the cyclorama, which was put up by the Provincetown Players in their small little narrow theater. It depends, which, and by the way, was inspired by Gordon Craig's work in the theater. It depends on so many things that it's not easily understood as literature. But one way in which I would hope people could begin recognizing the new impulses, new, in, at least in 1921, and still not really comprehended in the arts, would be to follow along a line of rhythm, to recognize that there are new rhythmic impulses. They aren't, of course, new to human existence, but the need to express them is new. And they will no longer, humans can't continue to carry the emotions they're feeling in rhythms that were essentially determined by horses and carriages, or riding horseback earlier yet, or so forth. In other words, there are, and in fact, external sounds have ceased to be the main point, because there's come to be a drive to express the inner mind. At the time in Provincetown Playhouse Group, attracted all to it who were interested in drama, Edna St. Vincent Millay wrote Aria da Capo for them. Even Dr. William Carlos Williams came over from New Jersey and hung around and was helped to put together some sets and got the inspiration for writing his plays. And I could go on and on, naming people famous and people who became famous and then were forgotten, and people who were considered very important at the time and who were too busy working to play the games of politics that get you printed or performed on a stage. But I want to follow the career of one person. I was reading in the book about a Louise that was one of the wildest flappers of this group. And in fact, when she turned down one of the Provincetown Players to marry someone else, he committed suicide, and that created one of the great scandals of that time. And I was imagining Louise facilely, as people do when they read a book about someone. And suddenly it named the man that she married, Verrez, Edgard Verrez. And that was Louise Verrez. And my brain almost turned entirely around, because that was the woman I had known in the 50s as that beautiful, graceful, strong, powerful, lovely, warm, elderly lady who invited us into the home of Verrez. By us, I mean myself and my composer friend Jim Tenney, and into his studio, where we were not permitted to smoke. And it was Louise who endeared us forever in the tension of meeting the great composer Verrez and listening to all his ideas, who leaned over and whispered to us while he was searching out a manuscript, "You know, you can go into the bathroom, and if you open the window about an inch, you can smoke and blow your smoke out the window, and Edgard will never know." It was also Louise who recognized that we weren't eating very well and who managed to provide for us sometimes as many as three meals called snacks in an afternoon. This sweet, wonderful person, who was, like so many others, someone who carried sparks from the Provincetown Playhouse early productions and O'Neill's unacknowledged, but absolutely should be clear to us now, theater of the mind. Verrez was entirely different than Louise. He was different than anyone I met. In fact, all different parts of his body were different, because he dressed in a multitude of plaids, plaid shirt, plaid tie with diagonals, a plaid coat of totally different color, plaid pants. He'd have worn plaid shoes, I'm sure, if they made them. And he was a walking example of the kind of music that he made. I'm going to play a piece now that he played to us at that first meeting. Their interpolations of what, or the tapes he was making for what was later to be his gigantic piece, Deserts, which included three tapes mixed with and interspersed by orchestral music. He played us just this tape, and I think it has an echo with O'Neill's theater and with the endeavor of most of the living artists I've known. So here it is, the third interpolation, the bare tape without orchestra of Edgard Verrez. ¶¶ So that piece by Verez I've chosen to play for you because in the spirit of this broadcasting, I want to provide things from my collection of tapes over the years, and odd and strange things, records that are out of print, poems from books often that are out of print, poets reading poetry and having conversations and so on. I want to present material which isn't available. Actually, for those that want to hear the full magnificent piece, it's available in several recordings, beautifully made Columbia recordings of the complete deserts, and in fact the complete orchestral works of Edgard Verez. But now I want to tell you a little bit about the story of how this piece came to be. Verez, after marrying Louise, did not just stay in the village. He stayed into the late 30s, as I understand it, until he had a nervous breakdown. A breakdown that was caused by the increasing neglect of music, the refusal to accept even what was at that time his rather more standard orchestral works. And pressures, all these pressures converging in his mid-age crisis, I suppose. And after all that initial excitement of the 20s, the society was burning down. Unless you were very, very social and could pick up on the social dilemmas of the times, as, say, Orson Welles did with his Mercury Theater. So anyway, for whatever all reasons, Verez cracked up and got into that position very much like the American composer Charles Ives had before him, and where he could not stand to hear any noise whatsoever, he'd begin to tremble. And Louise Verez, who was very good at translating, supported both of them across a 10-year period by translating the novels of Simenon. She also later did some beautiful translations of, for instance, Rimbaud. But during this period, it was just a bread-and-butter translating that would permit her to take him to Death Valley. which is where they lived, across from the late 30s to the mid to late 40s. And he recovered himself and began to compose, and it's across that period that he orchestrated and then began making, collecting these sounds to be interpolated within the piece. And that's why many people call him the father of electronic music. I mean, he was imagining electronic music back in the 20s and was working on it in the 30s and, of course, in Death Valley in the 40s, when there wasn't really anything but wire recorders and, of course, records that could be cut, but no way to control the sounds in the way in which he wanted to. He was anticipating the tape recorder. So that by the time I met him in the early 50s, he was still relying on these very early tapes. He had in 1952, I believe, the first performance of Deserts in Paris, France, and he was, of course, from France. Then came back and lived out his life in the village. I also want to be sure to include this story. What finally killed him was he went into a hospital for a hemorrhoid operation that he didn't even need, but would have made him more comfortable, and there was some problem with anesthesia, and he died on the operating table. But when I knew both him and Louise, they were among the most vibrant. He was at the height of launching, really, the whole involvement with electronic music in this country and abroad. He was concerned with where even sounds would mix in the very air. He was coming out of a tradition that I want to give you some example of, too. But his mainly, I want to stress that from the beginning, long before he became the father of electronic music, his drive was similar to O'Neill's and many others in the sense of needing to express something of the inner mind, the inner thought process at work, for which the old forms of music would not do. The filmmaker Ingmar Bergman said that, quote, "Art lost its basic creative drive the moment it was separated from worship. In former days, the artist remained unknown, and his work was to the glory of God." I would make the claim that it's all the same pursuit, but that the cathedral has become the mind, not in the sense of egocentric or a giant monument, which it also, unfortunately, is too often thought of, but as an endless way through to the universe and to forces and patterns that we don't understand. Just so that you don't think that this is only a modern pursuit, consider the Greek pipes that I played last week, and I'll be bringing some Indian pieces later. But I want to carry on the tradition of flute music with one of Varese's most lyric, beautiful, earlier pieces done, I believe, in the 30s, called Density 21.5. It finally came to that title because it took a platinum flute to play it, and here it is. Thank you. And now we'll close, as usual, this program with the tone poem, a piece of music called Seer, by the man I take to be the father of American music, Charles Ives.